Hello, everybody. Today is Wednesday, June 3rd. I am Bill Murphy here with the front pages. I'll be reading from the New York Times and the Hartford Current. And we will take a look at the pictures on the front page of the papers. On the front page of the Current, there are three. The Times I'll do first. The caption is the aftermath of a Russian strike on a residential building in Kyiv, Ukraine, on Tuesday. Moscow had warned of an attack for days. And that's going to be my first story. The picture is a picture of just complete destruction. Can't even make out the building, the remnants of it. And there's one soldier in the middle of all the rubble. In the background, you can see smoke billowing up into the sky. Again, I will have that story. The headline there is Deadly Russian Attack on Kyiv Comes with Psychological Toll. Another picture, I'm not going to have this story, is a picture of the Obama Presidential Center's 225-foot museum in Chicago. I'm just going to read the first paragraph. I'm not going to have the story, as I said. So the Obama Presidential Center has dropped on Chicago's south side. His signature building is a blocky, granite-clad museum tower that the former president wanted to look like four upraised hands. And it's kind of hard to see the hands, but that's what I guess it is, a huge white granite tower. And there's looks like a pond or river right next to the building. The other picture is a picture of the two NBA stars, Jason Brunson of the Knicks and Victor Wembanyama of the Spurs. They are going up for a rebound. It says meeting at the top, and they will be starting their best of seven championship series Wednesday in San Antonio. Should be a really good series. If you listen to the sports, there was quite a bit of information on that. Over to the Hartford Current. Headline here says a perfect day for play. And the first one I'm going to describe is a picture from Nevers Park in South Windsor. Picture is a place that says moms and youngsters enjoyed a warmer day, lots of sunshine. One of the pictures is a little boy named Cameron Mead. He's 1.5. He gets a hand from his mother, Megan, as he crosses a playscape at Nevers Park. And what a cute little boy he is. Got a little baseball cap on. Can't read what it says, but he's having fun walking across the playscape. And on the bottom, another picture, Cameron, Jill Bedard of Ellington, and she is in a swing, sitting in a sit-down swing, and on her lap are her two daughters, Stella, who's 1, and Alina, who's 4, and they are swinging high into the air, again, as they enjoy the weather at Nevers Park. The only other picture on the front page of the Current is a picture of State Representative Josh Elliott. He is a liberal Democrat challenging Governor Ned Lamont in the August primary and says he has reached the threshold to qualify for public financing in the race. A picture is him standing at a podium with several microphones speaking. It doesn't say who he's speaking to. And in the back, a big sign, big blue sign with white lettering, says Josh Elliott for Connecticut. We will now start with our stories. I'm going to start with the one that accompanies the picture about the attack on Kyiv from Kyiv, Ukraine. More than a week after Russia warned of an attack on Kyiv that would be so big that diplomats and other foreigners should flee, Moscow finally struck early on Tuesday. Its forces launched hundreds of drones and dozens of missiles at the capital and other cities in Ukraine, killing at least 22 people, the Ukrainian authorities said. The bombardment of Kyiv was similar in scale to two other deadly attacks last month. Moscow has continued its air campaign against the capital, even as the Russian military has suffered its worst period in years on the front line, measured in territory gained. What appeared to be different about the latest assault on Kyiv was the psychological element. Last month, Russia's foreign ministry issued dire warnings of retaliation for what Russian officials said was a Ukrainian drone attack. It struck a college dormitory in the Russian-controlled Luhansk region of eastern Ukraine, killing 21 students. The toll could not be independently verified. After Russia threatened another huge strike on Kyiv, including on, quote, decision-making centers, unquote, and told foreigners to evacuate, Western envoys rallied around the Ukrainian government, saying they would stay put and not give in to intimidation tactics. Still, Moscow's warnings and the long amount of time that passed before Russia actually struck took a toll on residents of Kyiv. For days, Russia launched aircraft in a manner that imitated a large attack, setting off alarms and wearing people down. Many families ended up sleeping in Kyiv subways and in parking lots for multiple nights. By Tuesday morning, as the first Russian drones crossed the border into Ukraine, shelters were full, less common than it was early in the war. A sight most common than it was early in the war, with people having gotten used to the threat of Russian strikes. Those who arrived in the middle of the night after the first missile warning struggled to find a place to lie down. Subway station floors were covered in tents and yoga mats. Dogs were barking. Children were crying, struggling to fall asleep. After the alert was lifted, sleepy families walked home as the sun cut through thick clouds of smoke over Kyiv. But shortly after 7 a.m., with some people already on their way to work, Russia hit the city with hypersonic ballistic missiles, Ukrainian officials said, leaving little time for people to seek shelter again. After the dozens of explosions that shook Kyiv overnight, several sites were still on fire on Tuesday morning. At least six people were killed, and three children were among the 65 injured. Mayor Vitaly Klitschko said a nine-story apartment building in the Podilsky district west of the Dnipro River partly collapsed, he said. In the city of Dnipro in central Ukraine, 16 people were killed, including two children, and 37 injured as a result of an overnight attack, according to the local authorities. Overall, Russia launched 656 drones and 73 missiles in the overnight wave of strikes, according to Ukraine's Air Force, which reported that 33 missiles had hit their targets. It was perhaps the most advertised attack of the war. Russia warned on May 25th of its plan to strike, quote, decision-making centers, end quote, in Kyiv. On Monday, President Vladimir V. Putin led a meeting in the Kremlin about the alleged Ukrainian drone strike on the college dormitory in Luhansk, saying that the attack had added a new quality to the conflict as a whole. Ukraine's government has described the Russian assertions about the strike as misinformation, but a Ukrainian news outlet identified civilian victims, including students. The Russian Defense Ministry said in a statement on Tuesday that the overnight attacks were a response to what it called terrorist attacks on targets in Russia. Mikhail Samus, the director of the independent New Geopolitics Research Network in Kyiv, said one of the most important aspects of this wave of Russian threats and attacks was, quote, the cognitive component, unquote. Then he added, involves changing Ukrainian psychological state and forcing them to take to the streets and demand an end to the war. Increasing the scale of attacks while simultaneously emphasizing the cognitive opponent is what Russia is likely to continue doing, Mr. Samuel said. Russia has been bombarding Kyiv and other cities for years, since long before Ukraine developed the capability to strike back. But in recent months, it has ratcheted up its attacks. Every major assault on Ukraine city seems to achieve a record of one kind or another. The most drones used, the most ballistic missiles fired. On May 14th, Russia launched more than 1,400 drones at Ukrainian cities over 24 hours, the largest drone attack of the war, according to a data set created by the New York Times using numbers drawn from the Ukrainian Air Force. A single ballistic missile fired as part of that bombardment killed 24 people in Kyiv. And now to the front page of the New York Times for this story from Washington. President Trump on Tuesday named Bill Pulte, that's P-U-L-T-E, who has pressed for investigations into the president's foes, to serve as the acting director of national intelligence, giving him oversight of U.S. intelligence agencies. He will replace Tulsi Gabbard, who announced last month that she was stepping down to care for her husband, who has cancer. Mr. Pulte, who leads the Federal Housing Finance Agency, has no known background in intelligence, defense, or national security, but he has been among the most aggressive advocates for prosecuting Democrats and others perceived by Mr. Trump as having crossed him. The Director of National Intelligence is a cabinet post that oversees 18 intelligence agencies and supervises the production of the president's daily brief, the compendium of intelligence analysis viewed by senior policymakers. The appointment was viewed with deep skepticism on Capitol Hill. Democrats immediately denounced it, saying that Mr. Pulte did not have the national security experience the law creating the office required. Multiple senior Republicans also voiced doubts. We don't need a weaponized DNI, Senator John Thune of South Dakota, the majority leader, told reporters. We need professionals there. Mr. Thune added, if he's somebody we want in that position permanently, he's got a lengthy road ahead of him. For now, Mr. Trump seems intent on avoiding the confirmation process, maybe Mr. Pulte to the National Intelligence Post on an acting basis. Mr. Pulte will continue to run the housing agency while taking on the new position which he wanted and lobbied for, according to U.S. officials. The Federal Vacancies Reform Act generally limits acting officials to a baseline of 210 days. While Richard Grenell was the acting director of national intelligence in the first Trump administration, he served for 96 days. Mr. Trump started calling allies about the appointment over the weekend, but the announcement surprised many senior officials at the office of the director of national intelligence. Mr. Pulte did not respond to a message seeking comment. On paper, the director of national intelligence, a role created after the September 11 terrorist attacks, is among the most powerful cabinet positions, responsible for coordinating the work of the CIA and a host of other agencies. But Mr. Trump has never seen it as an important role, his advisors have said. And in his first term, he believes staff members working for the office were leaking information about him. And I have one more story on the front page of the New York Times. It's from Washington. Todd Blanche, the acting attorney general, said on Tuesday he was withdrawing a proposal to create a $1.8 billion fund to compensate people claiming to be victims of unfair prosecution amid a revolt among Republicans who saw it as an ethical and political disaster. We're not moving forward with the fund, period, Mr. Blanche told members of a House Appropriations Subcommittee. He repeated himself to make clear that he meant the fund proposal would be permanently withdrawn. His statement could break an impasse with Senate Republicans who had demanded the fund be scrapped as a precondition for passing a major immigration enforcement bill. Opponents had described the proposal as a slush fund for allies of President Trump. But Mr. Blanche said that he would leave in place an order he signed last month that would, in fact, block the IRS from investigating Mr. Trump, his family, and his businesses for existing tax violations. Nothing has changed with that, said Mr. Blanche. Said that added that the tax order would not shield Mr. Trump and his associates from future investigations. Outraged, Democrats accused Mr. Blanche, the president's former defense lawyer, of cutting a sweetheart deal that would let the president and his family avoid a potential $100 million penalty. So the blanket immunity is not something that you're going to move back on, asked Representative Rosa DeLauro, Democrat of Connecticut, who accused Mr. Blanche of prioritizing the president's financial interests over the public good. You do not belong in this job, she added. Though Mr. Blanche has taken the fund off the table, much political damage has been done. In addition, the usually favorable tax deal provides Democrats with a potentially potent line of attack in the midterm elections that Republicans support shielding a billionaire president from tax penalties at a time when many Americans are struggling financially. Democrats requested that Mr. Blanche commit to rescind in writing his order creating the payout fund. You started it. You established it in writing, so it just makes sense to rescind it in writing, said Representative Greg Meng, Democrat of New York. I'm not committing to put anything in writing, he said, adding that he would abide by his word and would take the request under advisement. The testimony came a day after the department committed to abiding by a federal judge's order, pausing the fund's implementation until at least June 12th, a decision some administration officials privately said could provide an off-ramp to unwind the plan. Mr. Blanche, appearing last month before the Senate Appropriations Committee, had offered few details about how it would be carried out and declined to guarantee that the money would not be doled out to those who ransacked the Capitol on January 6, 2021.